This podcast is produced by Unedited.
The Songwriters Podcast is in association with the Ivers Academy and PRS for Music M Magazine. My name's Louise Golby. I'm an independent artist and I've been writing and performing my own music for quite a while now. As a songwriter myself, I'm very interested in the art of songwriting, how song ideas come about, what triggers certain lyrics, or how a melody or musical idea is started. In this series, I've interviewed some of the UK's leading songwriters and artists, discussing their songwriting techniques and stories behind their biggest songs and collaborations. My guests have written tracks for the likes of Stevie Wonder, Adele, Tina Turner, Kylie Minogue and Cher, as well as receiving MBEs, Grammys, Ivor Novello's, Brit Awards and number one singles for their work. My guest for this episode is a British songwriter, musician, record producer and DJ. She has been nominated for Brit Awards, the Mercury Music Prize and has several global number one hits and multi-platinum records under her belt. She has collaborated with artists such as Dido, Boy George, Becky Hill, Wiley, An Example, to name a few. For the past 25 years, she has been the musical force behind the iconic electronic dance act, Faithless, selling over 15 million records, headlining festivals and stadiums, and changing the face of the UK dance scene. With the tragic passing of frontman and lyricist Maxi Jazz in December last year, their legacy is even more poignant. I am extremely honoured to be interviewing Sister Bliss about her songwriting techniques, stories behind some of her biggest songs, and her highly successful music career to date. I started with a question I've been asking all of my guests. If I was to introduce you with just one song, what would it be?
Oh, if I could only get some sleep. Creaky noises make my skin creep. I need to get some sleep. I can't get no sleep.
The interesting thing about insomnia was it was actually part of our first album, Reverence, and it was meant to balance the only other Dials track on the album, which was Sal Vermeer. And we conceived the album as an A and a B side of a mixtape. And you put all your favourite music on that tape, a bit of reggae, a bit of dub, maybe something ambient, something chilled, a bit of hip hop. So it was very eclectic. And we realised that Sal Vermeer was quite an uncompromising piece of music and we needed something that was a little bit more accessible. And I remember coming into the studio, having been DJing nearly every night of the week, saying, right, we're doing a track, I'm going to call it Insomnia because I can't get no sleep. And we literally said to Max, can you write a song about insomnia? And he kind of scratched his head and went away and thought about it and came back with the now iconic lyrics.
Insomnia was the band's second single and became their most successful. Originally released in 1995, it got to number 27 on the UK singles chart and topped the UK dance chart. On its re-release in October 1996, it reached number 3 in the UK singles chart and topped the charts in Finland, Norway and Switzerland, as well as the American and Canadian dance charts. The song featured on Faithless's 1996 debut album, Reverence. It is quoted as one of the best dance records of all time and went certified double platinum in 2019. Following the passing of band member Maxi Jazz, Insomnia charted at number 4 on the UK singles downloads chart.
I remember very vividly because we'd made the music first. We had a sort of pizzicato sound that we'd used on Sal Vermeer. So we used a very similar palette of sounds for Insomnia. And literally, I just sat down and played the riff. I remember Rollo saying, put some strings on it and make them sort of classical. That was the kind of instructions I would get. So really, I'd just be kind of freestyling at the keyboards and various things would just come out. And that particular day when we started Insomnia, I do remember it being so ridiculously casual. There was no inkling that this record was going to become a kind of defining record of an era or decades later still, incite such excitement in crowds across the world. We were rushing because that round the corner from the studio, which was in a garden shed in Islington, was a great secondhand record store. And we'd really set our hearts on going record shopping that afternoon. So that's what we did. It was like, yeah, come on, you know, like, please just put some beats in, like, hurry up. Could you just, okay, that's quite a good riff. Yeah, all right. Literally, we went off record shopping, didn't really think much about it. And then we went into a big studio up the road to record Maxie's vocals. And he'd actually done an extra verse. There's a whole other verse of Insomnia that nobody knows about. But it made the song too long, so we kind of cut it down. And then we didn't really think much about it. We pressed it up, and I used to play it out quite a lot. And it wasn't until a few months later it really started to kind of gather a following as a record, in terms of people would actually request it. And then they'd start singing along to the lyrics. Then they'd start singing the riff. And that's how you knew in these analog days before the internet that this song was actually connecting with people. But what was interesting was we did a radio edit. We had radio pluggers at the record label, which was our own independent record label, Cheeky. We took it to Radio One and they said, there's no hook, there's no chorus in it, go away. And it was quite bizarre. So we were kind of like, okay, we just carried on. It was actually about a year later, Pete Tong, who's still at Radio One, campaigned for us to re-release it. Said, listen, guys, you know, there's something about this record. It's really special. It's starting to blow up. And it had started to blow up all around Europe. So we sort of re-imported our success from Europe and re-released it. And in this time, they'd sacked a huge amount of people at Radio 1 and completely changed the culture there. They'd realised that a lot of people were listening to electronic music, dance music is currency, and they were really missing a trick if they weren't plugging into that youth culture and supporting it on the radio. So instead of it being kind of marooned on either pirate radio or specialist dance stations, it became a mainstay on daytime radio. And that's when everything kind of kicked in and it became a global hit. And we released it the same week as the Spice Girls as well. I think it might have been their second single, which was a very canny move by the guy that ran our record label. Because in those days, it was all about footfall, i.e. people going to the shop to buy the physical album or single. And it was also about something called racking, which meant where your song was placed. So it was visible on a rack hanging on a wall. And we were racked next to the Spice Girls. And because there was Spice Girl mania, people saw the Faithless record. And also a lot of people had heard it in Ibiza in the summer. This was in the days when, you know, a summer holiday could also break and make a record, whether it was Macarena or even indeed Faithless. I mean, I think we released it in November. So we gave it a good run, but it built up this kind of head of steam. And from then, what can I say? It opened the doors to the rest of my life as a musician.
The fact that you said that people can sing along to the riff, that's quite unique, isn't it? Because normally it's the lyrics that people sing along to. So to actually have people singing along to the musical part that you did must be amazing. Does it still give you chills when you play it live and you see the reaction from the crowd?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people aspect does. Obviously, I've heard the music so many times, but I'll never cease to be grateful for the, you know, the opportunities it afforded us. It gave us an audience. And then we came with the Reverence album, which, as I said, was really, really eclectic, went all over the place and was such a surprise to people. They'd often come to our live shows and think they'd come see the wrong band. So we learned to put Insomnia much earlier in the set. And then they'd be like, oh, it is those guys. Because we'd go into something called Flower Stand Man featuring, like, Dido was in the band in the early days. You know, it's like a kind of cool trip-hop song. Well, there was something with opera in it and things that were really not what you'd imagine a dance band to do. It wasn't one banging track, one after another. Some of it was really rootsy and soulful as well. And I think that's been one of the sort of very enjoyable challenges of being in Faithless, is making lots of different styles of music feel really coherent and of one band. So that's been something that has always, I guess, been part of my tools as a songwriter, is thinking, you know, today I'm really feeling like I want to express a very Joni Mitchell type side of myself, and tomorrow I want to be Prince, you know, wearing all these different musical hats and all these influences that fed into our music, and not being afraid to put it all out there and still be called an electronic band.
But the Insomnia track, the dynamic range, like you're saying about the tension, and also just having the piano paired with a thumping electronic drum, it's, I guess that's why it was kind of revolutionary, the fact that you had that musicality underneath this electronic dance track. So did you always use live instrumentation on all of your stuff with Faithless?
Some of it, yeah. It's a mix of synthesizers and samples. And I mean, all of it's played because I am a keyboard player. And if there are instruments I can't play, then we would get people in who could play. Like I remember on the very first album, we had someone down to play the accordion.
Oh, wow.
Quite randomly, creating a kind of sound of London, maybe back in the kind of Victorian era for one of the songs. So, you know, when required, if there are acoustic instruments that I can't play, then get people down to work with us. I mean, what I love about Faithless is there has been this sort of beautiful melding of electronics and acoustic instrumentation, from real strings to piano, you know, to guitars, bass guitars and so forth, but underpinned with a real electronic spine down the middle of it. And I am very obsessed with music that comes from the future. I really am. That's my great passion, something that sounds like it comes from another planet.
Oh, I love that. I want to start at the beginning. Tell us about your journey as a musician and songwriter. How did it all start?
Well, I think I've always been very intensely into music from a very, very young age. I would listen very intently. I would shush people if music was playing. And I kind of experienced it as if I was inside it. I found it a very immersive experience. And apparently I nagged and nagged and nagged to learn the piano. And I did start when I was 5. Consequently, I've got absolutely terrible technique. It wasn't like I started at 5 and I'm kind of like a concert pianist. It was like downhill from there on in. And I loved pop music and I loved synthesizers. My dad was a jazz musician as well. So that was always in the house, I guess, being exposed to all that kind of modal playing. So I was very lucky. I lived in a very musically appreciative household. I was a Charlie Parker records. My dad's favourite keyboard player is Keith Jarrett. Weirdly, I used to follow an amazing jazz pianist called Jason Rebello, and Maxi Jazz from Faithless used to perform with Jason. So there were these funny little moments of connection when we were first getting to know each other. Rollo, who produces Faithless and is, you know, the third part of our triangle, you know, doesn't play an instrument at all and does not like jazz, which is quite funny, but we have a huge passion for electronic music between us. So in my early life, I learned instruments. I taught myself instruments. I play very mediocrely on lots of different things. When I discovered Prince, I decided I wanted to be Prince. Didn't make a very good job of that. But, you know, I love that idea of playing absolutely everything because I can kind of hear how the parts should sound in my head. So I do play the bass guitar really badly and the keyboards and the viola. I did used to play the flute and the saxophone as well. Some of them self-taught, some of them I had lessons. But now it's just keyboards because you can get all those sounds anyway. But I love the immersion of music, of being in bands, being in orchestras, and all of those things. So yeah, I had a very rich musical experience, I guess. But I was passionate about pop music and the charts in particular, which made me not dedicated enough to become a classical musician at all. Certainly not dedicated or talented. But somehow Acid House spoke to me and I felt this enormous affinity with it. The jazzier side of it, the vocal side of it, the electronic sound, the rhythmic sound. Somehow all the dots kind of connected in my head.
Do you remember when you first realised you could actually write music with your skills on these instruments, when you felt like you knew this is my thing?
Weirdly, I did used to write tunes from about the age of 13. I'd kind of forgotten until someone reminded me recently. So my dad had a really old school original synthesizer in the house, which had like a floppy disk that you used to put in the front to get different grooves on it. And then he upgraded it and bought a little sequencer. And I used to write really dreadful poetry and then make these little pieces of music. They were quite 80s, quite like Human League-y and Bronski Beat kind of vibe to them. And I used to record them on a cassette. God knows where they are, but they are the very first demos, I guess, that I made. But it was very solitary exercise. And I would say I still make music in quite a solitary way. Sadly, I love being in the studio with other people, but often I do a lot of the groundwork on my own, sort of noodling away. Nothing's changed really since I was 13. God, that's sad, isn't it?
Apart from the fact that you're a hugely successful artist and
yeah, but I'm still
worldwide.
In my bedroom. Still haven't moved out of my bedroom. It's just got a bit more gear in it now.
And especially when you said your first record, what was that called? The very first one that you said got signed that you made?
Oh my gosh. So the first record we made was just really shit. So I shouldn't say that on the podcast. The first record we made was really not very special. Well, it had me singing on it, which was just awful. And it was a lot of fun, but it had a big riff in it. So I think we were getting the blueprint of our sound even back then. It was like 91 or 92, like really, really early. Whenever you make music, you have to kind of let it go. All of it is about practice. The more you do it, the better you get. And people get very hung up and think, oh, if that track doesn't make it, then nobody cares and that's the end of my life. And you've got to just keep putting out music and you will get better at it. And the law of averages is that something might connect. But if you only put out one piece of music and then you kind of hang all your hopes and fears and dreams on that, and you don't just move forward, and you have to develop a sort of resilience about rejection. So I've done lots of records that have been markedly unsuccessful, including the first Faithless album. We sold 16 copies a week when we first put it out. We just thought that was amazing and fantastic. We'd never put an album out, you know, and it took, again, at least a year for it to sort of snowball and connect. And of course, Insomnia being a big hit helped that process. But then again, a lot of people were buying one-off dance singles and they weren't necessarily going to know that an album existed. And that's why we were touring incessantly as a live band, really, to promote the idea that there was, you know, an amazing lyricist in Maxi, music that had a message, and that there was a whole album to enjoy. Although we did used to have to play some songs twice in the early days because the album was really short. And we thought, oh my God, we're only on stage for like 45 minutes. So we'd sort of play, you know, we'd do remixes of our songs, if you like, different versions of them, and play one at the top of the set and figure that everyone would probably have had a drink by the end and they wouldn't remember that they'd already heard it, which was quite a clever strategy, I like to think. Otherwise, if you've only done one album, you're all off in, you know, oh God, is it finished already?
How did you guys meet and how did, and, you know, form this amazing bond, the three of you?
All through one person, actually. I met a guy called Ben in a record shop over a pile of vinyl. We got chatting and I'd just bought an Atari off a bloke that I knew from Camden Market very randomly. And I taught myself how to use it and I was making tunes in my mum's bedroom. He said, let's make a tune together. And I was like, yeah, all right. Made a tune. He said, my friend's a producer. That friend was Rollo. He just had a hit with them, a track called Felix, Don't You Want Me. That was his first track, in fact, and it had gone on like 2.5 million copies. So he listened to our demo and quite liked it and said he would produce it for us. And that was the beginning of the relationship. And then a couple of years after that, the same friend came down the studio and said, I've met a Buddhist rapper from Brixton. And we'd found a button on said Atari that bought in the market that slowed the track down to a hip-hop groove in the middle. And Rollo said, we should, you know, get some sort of rapper on this middle bit. And that's how we got introduced to Maxi. And then, you know, carried on for another 25 years or so. So yeah, it was quite incredible. All happenstance, all just from an enthusiasm about music.
God is a DJ was released on the 24th of August 1998 as the lead single from Faithless's second studio album, Sunday 8 PM. The single reached number 6 in the UK and number 1 on the US Billboard dance chart.
This is where I heal my hurts. For tonight, God is a DJ.
Bizarrely, with God is a DJ, it started with a t-shirt. Our guitarist came into rehearsals wearing a t-shirt that said, God is a DJ. We thought, that's a really provocative statement. And it was at the time when clubs were becoming super clubs and everybody worshipped the DJ like a god. And the DJ from Manchester, Sasha, who was a legend, was on the front of a magazine with a caption, is Sasha God? Or something like that. And so there was a kind of, there was a slight tongue-in-cheek, you know, referring to that energy of the times. But then it actually became about something completely different. It had a huge message in it, you know, about the dance floor being a place of healing. This is my church. This is where I heal my hurts. And I do remember Maxi was sort of grappling with lyrics. I had written a lot of an instrumental, which I'd been road testing. So being a DJ in the band and the musician was really helpful. I could wear both those hats. done this instrumental, knew that it had legs, then something really powerful and exciting. And actually, the original, we used to have to cut dub plates, which run out after about 6 or 7 plays. So I'd be testing out in the clubs that I was playing. I remember I had like a 10-minute drum solo in it as well. We found some insane drum solo and sampled it in the beginning of the track. And then actually the final version didn't have it, but we did revert back to it for the live version in a weird way. But anyway, I remember Maxi grappling with the lyrics. We had the phrase, God is a DJ, you know, where did we go from there? And I do remember on the session, we were talking to Max, and then it was like, make a list, where do you find God? And then it just came, you know, it's in watching young life shape, it's in minor keys, solutions and melodies, enemies becoming friends, when bitterness ends. You know, these are all the places that I see God or godliness, i.e. beauty, truth, oneness. Because Maxi was a Buddhist, he was reflecting it all through a very Buddhist lens, which lent it this very unusual, I would say, poetry that you don't often find, well, in a lot of music, and particularly not in dance music, and sort of profundity, because it was directly addressing the people that would have their hands in the air in a club at a particular moment. It was a peak time record. And then obviously that one became a global hit, but we did about at least 10 or 12 different versions before we landed on the right to finish version, because Insomnia, as I said earlier, was almost so casual in the way we wrote it. By the time we did God as a DJ, and we'd been around the world a couple of times, we realised we had an audience. We sold a few million singles, which was kind of extraordinary, and definitely a few 100,000 albums. You know, on our first go, you know, people call it difficult second album syndrome, and I see why. Because people are listening. Before they were listening, it just didn't matter. You could be free. You could throw anything at the record. You can make a record that's a mixtape for a friend with a bit of dub and a bit of reggae and ambient and whatever else on. And there wasn't anyone to answer to. Now there was an army of loyal fans and a sense of obviously not wanting to repeat ourselves. The interesting thing was when Insomnia became a hit, there was a rash of copycat records all using the same sound, which is very interesting as songwriters. It pushed us to move things forward. And for me, dance music is all about that anyway. It's looking to the future. Although now, of course, it has this catalogue and we can look to the past. But personally, you know, I want to be where the newest sound or plug-in is.
Mass Destruction was the first single from the fourth album by Faithless, No Roots, in 2004. It was released on the 31st of May and reached number 7 on the UK singles chart. A suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether your Soraway song or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could have Caucasian or a poor Asian. Racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether Halliburton, Enron or anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. We need to find courage.
We did a rough draft of the album and went away to listen to it. And I came away feeling that it wasn't about anything. It had moments of absolute loveliness, but it didn't have an agenda. And I just felt we were going to be judged so harshly if we didn't come back with something that, you know, created a relevance. And I remember making this little tune, like going back in the studio going, it's not right, it's not right. I mean, we started the album with a conceit, which was to do everything in the same key. So it was like, how do we make this album different from the other albums we've done? Oh, it's just going to be a mix of eclectic tunes and they'll say, same old Faithless. You know, this is kind of a bit before the internet, so the critics could really hang you out to dry. And it was very important to us to do something, again, that was pushing things forward. Mass Destruction is not a club tune. It was completely different tempo to what we usually recorded at. But we did say to Max, you've got to write something that addresses the state of the world. And he thought long and hard about it. And I had this kind of quite groovy but suppressed backing track. And he came in with the lyrics to Mass Destruction fully written. Hairs up the back of your neck, hairs on the arms. When you just know that something of absolute truth. And I feel lyrically that set the bar really high. And I remember us going, we have the key to the album. And then we changed everything around almost to put this piece of music at in the centerpiece of said album. And it lifted the whole songwriting process. You know, when you struck gold, there is a shift, there is an alchemy in that studio relationship, and we're all feeding off that energy. Mm. And if someone delivers something really special, you want to give it your best shot. You want the music to be amazing. So I'd often write music and Maxi would take it away when he was feeling it. And then he'd deliver something, we think, oh my God, the music has to be so much better because he's given us such a brilliant vocal. So that was the process often in Faithless. Sometimes Max would write with us in the room. Sometimes he'd take the music away and just listen to it in his own time. On occasion, he'd bring a lyric fully formed, but mostly he would write the music that we gave him, little demos in advance to see what he was feeling, really. And it kind of went from there. And it was always a snapshot of a moment in time. And, you know, I do believe music should have protest and politics in it if that's appropriate for the artist. And a lot of that can also come from a very personal perspective. That's what music is, you know, an expression of your deepest self. But sometimes it's also about storytelling and empathy and putting yourself in someone else's shoes. And Maxi had that unique ability as a storyteller. We would describe a scenario and he would just get it because he had an incredible empathy as a human and a poetry in his turn of phrase and a way of thinking about the world that had a profundity to it. And that, you know, he'd got some real hard-won wisdom in his life, and it was his mission to share it, and Faithless was the vehicle for that. So because we had this intent and purpose, that was, if you like, the conditions for the songwriting. Yeah, we want to get people dancing and partying, but ultimately we knew there was a mission, and that's what the band was for and stood for and still does, the kind of consciousness. I still think of us as a bit of a niche band because we're not like big like Beyonce or U2, but, you know, Maxi died recently, and the outpouring of love and the way the music and his lyrics especially had soundtracked people's lives in the most extraordinary way, not just on the dance floor. It was so moving and so humbling.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary, the deluge of messages. You know, I listened to your music when I had cancer, I buried my son to this, I married my wife to that. You know, I mean, just incredible, you know, people's life moments. In this day and age, music's a bit of oral wallpaper. It's just there all the time. You don't really have to make an effort to find it. But that these people had experienced our music in a really deep way. I mean, you can't ask for more as an artist. And maybe we did sell less records than Beyonce, but it sort of doesn't matter because we did our job. If people come back and say that, as a songwriter, I would say, that is the most gratifying thing. And I think maybe that's what also united us. It wasn't about the bling and being a celebrity. It really was about doing the best we could do, make the best shows, deliver something extraordinary, you know, within our own limited capacity. And Maxi would always say, oh, I'm not the best rapper. I'm not this and I'm not that. And I'm certainly not the best keyboard player. But I guess we all played to our strengths. And that transcended everything. That meant that we were all on the same page. We weren't sitting there squabbling on the studio and like, did you take that bit out? Oh, I like my bit the best. You know, it was always about trying to make the music the best it could be to deliver the song. I think back to the music that I connected with and I listened to so intently over and over again because I felt less alone, and that someone has experienced that with our music is the most beautiful kind of baton to pass on, isn't it?
I actually want to talk about the collaborations that Faithless had over the years. Artists such as Jazzy B, Wiley, Robert Smith, Boy George. What was it like working with featured artists in that process of songwriting and making those tracks?
The thing about Faithless was we often had people collaborate with us because to have Maxi on every single song, it didn't show all the different corners of the album. And we always wanted to have voices that complemented or contrasted Maxi. He was the central spine of it, along with the electronics. Mm-hmm. And then all the other things would weave things in and out. So you'd look forward to hearing his voice again, which allowed us to collaborate very naturally from album to album. But on the first album, one of the collaborators who was on a couple of songs, or maybe three songs, was Dido, because she was Rollo's sister. And she was just hanging around the studio, desperate to sing on anything. And so Rollo let her sing on the first record we did, which was Salva Man and Painter with a Curry, quite famously. And I guess that sort of set the bar as to what was possible. We also worked with singer Jamie Catto on the first album, had a sort of gravelly voice like Tom Waits. So there was a kind of weaving between Maxi's melodious rap and then actual sort of singer-songwriting as well. And it was putting all those things together. I guess because we did it from the first album, we carried on. And as Faithless grew in stature, we could, you know, reach out to people and say, would you like to come and work with us? Or we've got an idea for a song. Would you be up for doing a chorus? And Maxi does the verse. There were all sorts of different permutations. On the last album, Jazzy B was our legend contributor, and we'd wanted to work with him for years and years. Like, Rollo's massive soul to soul fan, and fair to say it completely changed his musical world when Soul to Soul released Club Classics. So it was really wonderful to have him in the studio. We actually talked about him and his life building sound systems for an hour before we even did any lyrics. We talked about Jazzy's history, and what was quite funny is when he came in the studio, it's like, what took you so long? Like, you've been waiting for the phone to ring. I was like, Jazzy B waiting for us to call. It was very flattering. But just the timing of his voice and what he means to British music and what he brought to the record, was a lovely experience. I would say 99% of our collaborations have all been really beautiful. I can't really think of any that have gone horribly wrong. There are some that haven't ended up on the record because stylistically or lyrically, suddenly the record might take a different turn, and then we would do a song with someone and it didn't fit. With suddenly the album's agenda revealed itself to us, and therefore a song didn't fit, or it made the album too long, and so forth. So there's no session that I've ever come out of and thought, God, that was absolutely awful. Also, some people we never meet. We send them lyrics and they send us, they record themselves. So Cat Power, who we absolutely adore, she's done her album, The Greatest. I mean, what an incredible voice and an amazing artist, with such sort of intimacy and vulnerability. And just loved her voice. Rollo just sent her some lyrics.
And so she wrote the melody.
That's right, she wrote her own melody. And then I completely rewrote the music. She'd just done something, I think, a guitar, and I just took it all out and completely rewrote the music with a very kind of electronic backing. So it was always lovely to have these moments of kind of delicacy as well on our albums.
With the other collaborations, Robert Smith, Boy George, was it a similar process, or was that more collaborative in the room?
Oh, with George was an amazing one, actually. I knew him from the club scene. I'd see him out DJing as well. And in a strange twist of fate, Rollo's dad was a publisher and he published Boy George's autobiography many moons ago. But we were in New York doing a very big show that was very important in front of Clive Davis, who is the head honcho of Arista Records. He signed Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin, the Eurythmics, Bruce Springsteen. And he was coming to see us, which was sort of faintly ridiculous, but we were all quite nervous. And the two of us was parked outside the venue, and there was a knock on the door, and it was George and a mate, wondering who was in the tour bus. And it was us, and he came, all of us, and just hung out with us and made us all laugh and literally wetting ourselves off. He's so funny. And then he came to the gig and he was jumping up and down in the front row, and he was just brilliant. And I remember at that point, must have been after that tour, we went to do a second album. I said, why don't we get in touch with George? You know, love his voice, he's amazing. Again, I think we started this backing track, and the song was called Why Go. I maybe recorded the chorus before George was there. Anyway, we decided to write a song about, it was quite bleak and sad. It was about the loneliness of kind of one night stands, which fitted with the general theme of the second album, which was all of our relationships were breaking up at the time. So that became difficult. Second album was all about touring the world and then coming home to absolute desolation and desecration.
Would you say your songwriting technique changes depending on who you're working with? So outside of Faithless, depending on who it's for and what it's for. And also, would you say your songwriting technique has changed over the years since you first started?
I don't think my approach has changed. It's always about chords, where my hands land on the keyboard, really. I had an interesting session with an artist called Becky Hill, who's very successful. I think she just got a Brit Award, in fact. And I haven't done a session like that for quite some time that wasn't a Faithless session, something for my own record that I didn't have control over. And it was actually really enjoyable, but it was a very different experience because I had no idea how the song will fit into an album or what the agenda for the whole record was. And I'm always thinking in that bigger picture and what kind of songs we need to create, you know, a real body of work, a real piece of work, an album that flows from beginning to end. And I still believe in the album as an art form. that was quite unusual because there was another keyboard player there. But we really bounced off each other. It was lovely. It wasn't a sort of, get out of the way, the keyboard's mine. It was really, really enjoyable. But not, I'm so used to coming to the studio with lots of different pieces of music and seeing what sticks.
And what about with the production side of what you do? Depressingly, there aren't that many female producers out there. So when you first started doing the production side, did you ever feel like you were treated differently or not taken as seriously? Same as, you know, when you started DJing.
Well, I've only kind of really done it in the studio for my own, you know, our own music. So I guess
it was always part of that.
Yeah, but I suppose maybe people don't know that, but Rollo and I produced our music together. He would always generally have the final say, or we would have a big row about it. But I, you know, I can produce something to finish it. I mean, I write very quickly. I feel I have to get the ideas out, but then things would start sounding like a big mush, and I had to learn some techniques just from sitting there and watching people. It was great up to a point, but then I went to City Lit and did a 10-week course, and it really helped. I was like, oh, that's what you do. That's how you get to not all sound muddy and muffly. So there were certain technical things I did need to bring into my arsenal as a producer. I guess having a vision about how things could sound, that's what producing is. Listening to other pieces of music to not just inspire, but, yeah, place your sound in a particular arena. So it doesn't sort of sound dated, and so that each record has got a different energy to it. So yeah, production is really important. Yeah, obviously it can bring out what the song is meant to be about. And you can get songs that you think are, they're not that amazing. And sometimes you put something on a particular sound and it just changes the way you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's as simple as changing key. Like a good producer can hear something and go, it's just a bit lightweight. And suddenly you drop it down a couple of semitones. You're like, oh, it sings now. I found what's good in this song. So that's very good for me, is working with someone, as I say, who's not an instrumentalist, who is able to hear without getting lost in the music. The way music is produced now, you know, digital workstations, mixing it with acoustic songs and acoustic instruments, whether algorithms will allow for music that sits in different genres within one song, for example. There are a lot of challenges. So there is a sort of, something that we sort of argue and hypothesize about a lot before we've even touched like an EQ or compression, is about where does the song sit? What lane is it in?
Well, talking of that, about that, another huge string to your bow is the stuff that you write for TV, film and theatre, which is a very different side of music composition compared to the dance and DJ world and your commercial hits. How do you find writing for those different purposes? How strict are the briefs you're given for the projects? Do you feel like you have to put on a different hat for this kind of writing?
Yeah, it is a different kind of writing. I think it's a great release in it for me, because it doesn't have to be a hit and it doesn't have to be a number one album and there doesn't have to be a tour. So it exists just for itself. If I write music for TV and film, it has to serve the picture. It has to please the director. It's not about my ego. They might have booked me for me, but ultimately it must work and must work with the emotion or the drama of what's going on. And that's very liberating. It's a really lovely way to work. And if nobody had given me the chance, I'd never have known that I really enjoyed that. And also working for the theatre was extremely collaborative. There was a lot of workshopping of the drama along, which helped me conceptualise the music. So watching people act and perform and dance and then writing music with those rehearsals in mind was also a really different exercise for me. Really good, really enjoyable. I want to do lots more of it. So yeah, watch this space.
So I want to talk about your recent single, Life is a Melody, which is a collaboration with Hyacinth and Apollo. Can you tell me a bit about how that song came about?
It came about really because I had had no gigs over COVID. And then last summer, it was just a pile up because there were so many postponed shows and they all kind of happened at once. It was very exciting. And there was this kind of wave of energy and this appreciation of, you know, watching people connecting with music once more in a communal setting. It was so sort of powerful and I'd missed it so much. And I was just inspired in the studio, and I ended up playing at this party in South London, and these guys were doing a live PA, and we just got on so well and had such a laugh together. And after the party, we said, do we feel a collaboration coming on? It was like, yeah. And I said, look, I've got this track I'm working on. I've been really excited to be back in amongst it. I have this feeling I want to make another anthem. You know, it's just for the dance floor. It's not part of an album. It's not part of a Faithless project. I just have this vibe with this track. Tell me what you think. One of the guys is a producer, DJ, a bit like me, and Sai Gennadi, the singer. And collectively, they've got this new project and they're calling themselves Hyacinth and Bolero. He was like, yeah, I'm really feeling the chords. You know, if I didn't feel it, I wouldn't suggest that we work together. So we literally just sat in the studio and vibed on different ideas and different melodies and, you know, what I wanted to say lyrically with the song, you know, and how music does heal and take away the pain of existence. And maybe that's a bit blatant. But it just, it's how it came out. And I was road testing it as well. So I can see that it's working in the clubs and the festivals. I started playing it out right at the end of last summer, various different versions of it. And then, you know, Christmas and life got in the way. And then it was like, right, let's find a label for it. I really want to put this song out. And Heeshin Day of amazing organization. They're a record label, but they're more than that. They're a platform and they're about diversity and inclusion. And one of the guys who runs it said, you know, if you've ever got any music you want to put out, please come and see me. I'd be so honoured to work with you. And I tapped him up and said, remember that conversation we had? Did you really mean it? Because I have actually got a piece of music and I feel I want it to have a home. I want to feel part of something again, part of a collective. And they said, yeah, we would love to release it. So it's on Heeshin Day out right now. And they're doing so much, I think, to really make dance and electronic music and performing a safe space and a really varied space. They've got some really interesting artists on the label as well. So I just feel really excited to be on a label where I feel I'm in really good company and I really believe in what they stand for.
What is the song you're most proud of as a songwriter? So it's basically your favourite song you've written personally. Doesn't have to be your most successful, but maybe one you're most proud of musically?
I think Mass Destruction I'm very proud of because the album No Roots went straight to number one after we'd released that single, which was very exciting. And it was totally uncompromising. It wasn't, you know, pointing at the universality of the dance floor. It was an anti-war protest song. And it got quoted in the US Senate. And the music was quite suppressed. And it was groovy, but it wasn't, you know, playing to the usual gallery. It was quite anarchic and quite punky. And it definitely took on a whole nother level live. And it was the most exciting song to play in our live sets. So I'd say I'm really glad that all the doors opened by Insomnia led us to be able to make a piece of work that has some kind of, yeah, a bit of legacy to it, I guess. That dared to be political and criticise Enron and Halliburton. I mean, who does that in a lyric? And in fact, it's the song that Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters and formerly Nirvana says he wishes he'd written. Can't get
well, there
more
you go.
Of an accolade
well,
than that. And that was the song that nearly wasn't on the album because the album was a bit lame. Until we went to Max, you've got to write something and it can't be lame.
That's the best brief ever. Funnily enough, your Dave Grohl comment leads me nicely to my final question, which is, what is the song you wish you'd written?
Oh, I mean, I should return the favour, shouldn't I, and say Smells Like
Dave
Teen
Grohl.
Spirit. But I'd probably say pretty much anything by Kate Bush. I mean, the man with the child in his eyes. I mean, what was she, 14 years old or something ridiculous when she wrote that song? I mean, the gifts in that woman's little finger outshine, you know, every cell in my body. One song that I keep coming back to is the On the Moon-Shaped Pool, the Radiohead album. Is it Daydream?
Beyond the point of no
It's just such a mesmerizing piece of music. If you can make music and it is gossamer, that's what that song is. Something that's impressionistic but still incredibly precise. It sounds like gossamer, utterly ethereal, but so beautiful.
To find out more about Sister Bliss, please visit facebook.com/thesisterbliss or follow her on Instagram at thesisterbliss. And to hear some of Sister Bliss's work, please listen to our specially curated playlist. The link is in the episode notes. To find out more about me, please visit my website, which is louisegolby.com. And for updates about the Songwriters Podcast, please follow and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. This series of the Songwriters Podcast is produced by Christopher Mitchell for Unedited. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode.